Paperman meets such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we try to give you some insight into journalistic decision making and some of the ethical challenges that confront those folks who try to bring you the truth every day.
Good luck.
All right, we're on. I'm Rex Smith of the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union, and I am going to try to moderate this bulky panel here this morning.
Bulky?
Imagine that.
I got a sweatshirt on, but I don't think I was bulky.
No, bulky. Sorry, it was my vowel production. It was problematic. That's Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette and formerly vice president here at Press Association, keeping my enunciation in line. Thank you, Judy.
You're welcome. You know, I've been trying to wrap my head around this Tucker Carlson, Steve Bannon, Ted Cruz, Donald Trump tiff, the series of arguments or disagreements, and actually what it means for the larger media environment and for our coverage of what's happening in the Middle East.
Cool. I think we ought to talk about that right-wing inner battle, right? The Civil War, supposedly, and what it means. We are joined by two of our colleagues, our hosts here from WAMC, News Director of Northeast Public Radio, Ian Pickus. Here he is.
Hi, everybody. I've been thinking about what it's like to be in an election season when you are paying the closest attention to a race and yet may not have a vote in a race because you work in the news.
Ah, because you don't live in the district, but you're covering it?
No, because I'm not registered in a political party in a machine town.
Of course, exactly. That is a very interesting issue. Journalists who choose to not be enrolled in a party.
People have been knocking on my door, but they're not excited to see me.
And our producer, David Gustina, is here in front of the microphone. What's going on?
I, too, am not registered in any party.
Enrolled is the term we use in this
state. Excuse me, enrolled. Sorry. Don't be bulky. All right? And I'm seeing the tea leaves here in an article we have this week with Americans turning to social media and video for news more than any other source. Oh, how we've fallen.
That actually is what really interests me too, David. I think that's a really remarkable moment. I don't know if we've fallen, but it is a survey. Social media and video networks have overtaken television to become the most widely used source of news among Americans. This is a new Reuters Institute poll. You know, there was a time when, of course, newspapers were how people got information, and then along came radio and everybody said, well, that's going to really dump newspapers. And then along came television and everybody said, so much for newspapers and radio. But actually, digital media has done it. Now, people may not know where they are getting information, but 54% of Americans say they had accessed news via social and video networks within the past week. TV and online sites were the next most common source. But what does this mean if we know that digital media delivery, that is social and video networks, if we know that the mode of delivery tends to be quick in order to reach folks' attention span, what does that mean for the kind of news that takes priority and for how it's presented if that's where people most get the news? I worry that we in the media don't really yet know how to deliver it well on those platforms, and therefore that's one of the reasons why people aren't getting as much information, because we're not doing our job well enough at delivering the news on what is now the dominant platform. You think?
I think that's part of it. And I also worry about the idea of influencers being able to create the narrative for the new news consumers, where we, many of us, and it says we're still up there second place, turn to more mainstream media outlets, the journalism of verification like the New York Times and the Washington Post and others. And even those have problems. But when you look online and you see that most people of a younger age are now following individuals, not following institutions that are known to practice those journalist values the way we'd like to see people understanding the world. If you only are following influencers, you're going to get a skewed perspective.
Hey, can I bring this back to Tucker Carlson, who lost his perch, as they say, on cable news? And I thought he was just going to walk into the sunset and never be heard again. But now he has been the talk of the town for the last week because he has his own streaming video on YouTube, and he's acquired a fairly substantial subscriber list, and he's still making news. I think there are so many different ways for people who used to be important on cable news or in the other forms of mainstream media are finding new platforms and can be as outrageous as they want to be.
Like the Upstate American, I'm just outrageous, right? If only.
The thing I struggle with this question is, you know, I just listened to the New York Times reporter Eric Lipton doing a 48-minute fresh air interview on the conflicts of interest that President Trump and his family have in running official Washington. And it was pretty heady, confusing stuff to follow. They're invested in a bunch of countries. They're hosting foreign leaders and profiting from the foreign leaders' investments. And they're selling Trump coins and so on and so forth. And after 48 minutes and having read a lot of his reports, I kind of understand it a little better than I did, but there's no way that's going to be a 7-second video to give you any sort of nuance to really understand an issue. In some cases, that's possible, but I think news consumption is work to a degree, and the more you put into it, the more you'll get out of it. And as we trend toward these short videos and talking heads talking about a primary source in a 10-second mode, we will lose some nuance and some understanding. I just think that's, you know, here in public media where we have nothing but time to break down issues, those of us who consume it are getting more in many cases than those who don't.
Yeah, we used to do this with bullets, you know, bulleted items. USA Today, maybe 40 years ago now, maybe 50 years ago, you know, made the big breakthrough of doing this kind of distillation of the important facts or the important moments of a story. But you know, what we're getting away with is an America that doesn't appreciate the beauty of a wonderfully written paragraph. You know, we've lost the appreciation of good writing that we used to get, or good listening that we used to get in a newspaper. It's still there. It's just not being appreciated.
This is what drives me crazy with Axios, because Axios has incredible sourcing, and they break a ton of really important stories. And it's so dumbed down for a scroller to be able to look at 3 bullet points, you know, why it matters. And it doesn't give a lot of credit to the audience.
The traditional heading being but, right?
Right.
That is the other side of things, is the but. But, you know, we can't entirely absorb the responsibility ourselves as journalists, because it's an education issue, isn't it? I was talking with a professor the other day who was just saying, if we really faced up to the literacy issue in America, to how many students actually lack literacy, which numbers, by the way, the United States no longer reports to some international clearinghouse in this issue, we would see that people just aren't reading.
Also, the enemy is us. I mean, if you think about driving down the highway and there's a car accident and everything slows down and people are stretching to see what happened, it's the sensationalized video and even in radio audio and those kinds of things that are a real turn on for people to tune into, whereas the boring, in-depth stories that may have a much bigger impact on the population often don't get read or overlooked because of the bells and whistles that some stories come with.
If you look back at the Kennedy-Nixon debates of 1960, it's very interesting to actually look at those. If you go over to the John F. Kennedy Library, it is remarkable to look at those debates and to see the depth of the conversation about topics that were important to people compared to the way that we interact on issues these days. Americans really are much less so. One of the statistics from this study, the Reuters study into where people get their news, 73% of the respondents in the United States said they are concerned about their ability to tell what is true from what is false, compared to 46% of the respondents of Western Europe. 73% in the U.S., 46% in Western Europe say they don't know what's true and false. That's problematic.
I think that goes to leadership in some sense of the word. And as one of our articles points out, for the last 10 years, Trump has been attacking the media and embracing a sort of conspiracy theories and dabbling in confusing the issue of truth. Bold-faced lies, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Things like January 6th, for example. They're just tourists. No, they're not. So when you start to do that, and he has the bully pulpit, and he's the president of the United States, he's messing with our ability to understand what the truth is.
You know, in Europe, they do not have the tremendous segmentation of the news media that we do. I mean, they have the BBC. They still have some mainstream media sources that people trust more so than we do here in the States. I think that is one of our biggest downfalls as well. But you know what? Let's put some responsibility on the people themselves. I had a sports editor one time who would tell readers who called up to complain about this story or that story, you know, because they hadn't read it. And he said, you know, I can't read the stories to you every day. You have to take some responsibility to actually go through the story and see the facts for yourself. he said it more than once.
Also, you paid $1 for this product, not right. For nothing.
Yeah. You get what you pay for. But, you know, I mean, to David's point, Donald Trump has issued, by one count, 3,500 social media attacks on the press over the last 10 years since he glided down his golden escalator and into our lives. And if you average that out, you get an anti-media post just about every single day. And that is going to have an impact with people who believe him in any case. So not for nothing is the United States now in a position where there is a lack of trust in everything.
And if you follow that forward, you could even apply that in some sense to what's happened with the No Kings protests and the attacks, the physical attacks on media, on journalists who are covering this. And the idea that because the president has put the bullseye in many ways on journalists covering events, and immigration is such a hot button issue, and many in law enforcement, as we've talked about before, tend to have a right of center view of things. You can see why it might be a little fun for them to shoot a rubber bullet at a reporter with the idea, well, we're really not going to hurt them, but we're going to let them know we don't like what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. And let's be clear, those bullets can be harmful.
They
even can be lethal, even though they're described as non-lethal. I like the trend nowadays to just describe them as non-lethal because it's far more accurate than just saying they're harmless shots. They weren't just harmless shots. They can really cause damage.
Washington Post started using the term less lethal.
Hmm. Good point.
That's a good
Words
one.
Matter.
A good thing. So, Judy, you were interested in this Tucker and Trump. You know, you've got Tucker Carlson saying we can't go to war. You've got Fox News basically thumping the tub for American engagement in the Iran war. What do you make of this?
You know, at one point, Tucker Carlson was in the top round of consideration for vice president for Donald Trump in the second round. I can remember that being a consideration. And now he's criticizing Donald Trump's consideration of getting involved in any war in the Middle East. And you've got Donald Trump responding, I don't know what Tucker Carlson is saying. Let him go to a television network and say it so that people listen. At one point, he called him kooky. And then Tucker was on Steve Bannon's War Room, and he strongly criticized his former network, Fox News, and said that they promote propaganda to manipulate their elderly audience. And what this illustrates is that, you know, again, the segmentation of our news media, and also the differences within the Trump supportive MAGA party about what's going to happen in the Middle East. But it's coming out in these different venues, which is you really need to pay attention to everything, because until it filters its way down to the Washington Post and the New York Times, I don't know about it because I do not watch the War Room.
The War Room is anti-war,
and they can be so mean to each other, and the rhetoric is so high. You know, a lot of people on the left are saying, "Yeah, it's nice to agree with Tucker Carlson for a change," but they are not welcoming him to the resistance at this point.
And one of the interesting elements about the emergence of individual platforms, as we're talking about Tucker Carlson, the Tucker Carlson Network, as he calls it, and the capacity of people now to be their own creators is, you know, in my small scale, I am. The Upstate American is my voice. Mike Huckabee did that after he was governor of Arkansas, and after he failed to run for president, he created a Huckabee newsletter called the Huckabee Post. So now he's the ambassador to Israel. The Huckabee Post continues to churn out copies, continues to publish, actually. His son has taken it over. I was interested, by the way, that it apparently is yielding him about $500,000 a year, which is somewhat more than...
Yep, State American.
Yeah, you might stop hosting this program if you got that kind
of... Rex, you got to learn the bass guitar.
All these opportunities. But it is really interesting how one of the elements that people had said was going to change the world with the rise of digital media 30 years ago, people were saying, well, it's going to empower individual voices. Initially, it didn't, but now this is happening. Individual voices now are being elevated, or as you mentioned earlier, David, they are influencers, tend to be. But individual voices can be heard, and in some cases, it of course yields a conflict of interest. If you got the ambassador to Israel with a newsletter that gets out there that's making him a lot of money, which is taking a stance on America's involvement in the Middle East, there are some issues there.
Right. Ethically, he is supposed to step away and not be directly involved in this, but apparently they are getting, every once in a while, they'll get an exclusive from their ambassador or their former guy, and Huckabee will provide some information. He told us he wasn't going to be involved, that he was going to let his son run this thing, but that's not what's happening sometimes. I think this is partly on Substack. They're kind of taking a hands-off attitude. They want their contributors or their participants to abide by legal and ethical rules, but I'm not sure they really lay them out for everybody so they know what they are.
Yeah, presumably, I mean, the State Department can set up a blog spot for Mike Huckabee if it wants to, and he can put his newsletter there for the term. I mean, what's so wrong with that?
The State Department does, by the way, actually have its own Substack channel. Everybody seems to have their own, and a lot of members of Congress are using Substack, not for pay. I mean, obviously, you can put stuff out on Substack without asking for subscription dollars. But still, everybody seems to be deciding that it's another way of getting information out there.
You know, there are so many sources of information that come into my feed every day, into my inbox, that my email fills up faster than it did when I was a newspaper editor.
Yes.
And I wish they could come up with some sort of, you know, platform that would collate everything and, you know, tell me what the most important things are.
Like a newspaper.
Because, I mean, again, every day, you know, and oftentimes, many times a day, 3 or 4 times a day, I'm getting the, you know, we're going to do a live broadcast. We've got a live update. I can't keep up. And if it's a 43-minute podcast, there's only 24 hours in a day. And as fascinating as some of those long podcasts are, there is a limit on time and there is a limit on our attention. And
especially if you don't go to 1.5 speed. Which some people do.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was an option.
Don't do it. Don't start.
It'll scramble your head. Yeah, once you start. Woo. You're listening, by the way, if you have just tuned in. This is The Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith.
On regular speed, we hope.
Judy Patrick. I'll speak very quickly.
I'll decide that.
Ian Pickus, David Gustina, our producer, who's going to speed us up. We may be going faster than we think, even as we're speaking. By the way, we always are happy to hear from you. Thank you, Courtney, who wrote to us. An interesting point of view. Listen to this from our listener, Courtney. It made me uncomfortable seeing the photos of and story about the Minnesota captured suspect who took the lives of the Minnesota couple and nearly took the lives of the other couple. This is that political assassination. I have been curious about the story, and awareness is always good. I just didn't like seeing this on the website. Sometimes I get a similar feeling with a front page newspaper story. So this goes to that whole issue of coverage of suspects, right? Is this appropriate? Do you have a policy, Ian, on this here?
I mean, we very rarely are running mugshots, but in this case, the guy was at large. They were trying to find him, and this, I think, clearly rises to that level.
It is interesting. We do, I think, a lot of newsroom decision makers say, you know, we don't need to list the name of a victim in many of these crimes. That is a change over the past, I'd say, 20 years or so. It used to be that if somebody's purse was snatched, the poor person whose purse was snatched was also in the news. And I think with the concept of the journalistic notion, minimize harm, the notion has been, let's not do that. But when you have a suspect in a crime, as you say, at large, I think generally we use the names of the suspects and the killers.
Well, and our job is to provide information, right? I mean, part of that information may be the picture of the person that we're talking about. And if we have it, we should probably go with it, you know, notwithstanding what you said, which is important. But that's what we do. And, you know, we didn't say no harm.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
So we're not out there, to put out smiling pictures of people. When a suspect is named and it's a high-profile case like this one and they're still looking for them, as Ian said, it makes perfect sense.
Right. We don't take the Hippocratic Oath here in journalism. We just try to follow good ethical guidelines. Judy, you're being unusually quiet.
Well, you know what? The case for using the photo is very clear when he's at large. But I also found it valuable to see his photograph even afterwards. And it may be the bias on my part, but I said, oh, he looks like everybody's grandpa. And again, it's my biases. I would have thought he would look different than that. Going forward, it's going to be a challenge for the news media, I think, and how to cover this trial when all the perp walks, or what happens with him going forward. I mean, because appearances can be deceptive, appearances can be misleading, so.
So we are in election season on some local races, and I just have to draw attention before we run out of time here to a most interesting race, the race for mayor of New York City. Outside most of our listeners, I'm sure we have some in the city, but there's a journalistic issue in this, and that is that the predominant information voice in the city, the New York Times, announced last summer that it wouldn't be doing endorsements in local races anymore.
And we talked about it.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. We thought, no,
we didn't like it.
Yeah. And now the Times has published something that looks an awful lot like an endorsement.
It looks like a dog.
Sure does.
It says, don't do this candidate. Think about this candidate. Think about this. It's very odd. And so I guess it goes back to that real question of what is the value of a newspaper endorsement, and is there a responsibility for newspapers to do this?
Or why did they bother to say what they said last summer? I mean, as we were talking about earlier, never say never. Keep your options open. You need to be flexible. I don't know what precipitated the decision last December, but I agree. I think that a local newspaper needs to let its readers know what's happening in a race. And I had no problem with the actual editorial. I had a problem with them reversing course.
Yeah, that's the mistake, saying never, we're not going to do this anymore. Because look at what's happening in this New York City primary right now.
Yeah.
With, at the top, Andrew Cuomo, the former disgraced governor, who, if he gets elected, and it looks like the polls say he will, have to work with his former lieutenant governor, Kathy Hochul, who he doesn't have a good relationship with, right? He's got all sorts of problems with President Trump and the Trump administration. So this is a very, very not only interesting race, but a race that should be commented on by the lead journalistic operation in New York City, the New York Times. Their analysis is good.
Hey, and poor Ian can't vote in his race.
Yeah,
oh, that's the big one.
I have a disagreement, with people like Peter Baker and Jim Lehrer, who famously wouldn't vote in a campaign because they didn't want to have, even in their own bones, the potential for a bias. And I've always felt that they probably knew more than 99.9% of any voter voting in that race, and they could make a decision. And I feel like this Times editorial just wound up being lame.
Yeah.
They said, we hope we have better candidates in 2029.
Yes.
Leave Cuomo and Mamdani off your ballot. But they never said, here's who you should vote for out of this field. I mean, elections are choices. There are a finite number of people you could possibly elect as the next mayor. One of them is going to be the next mayor. If you're going to do the editorial, you might as well use all of the knowledge and all of the editorial board interviews and watching these people in public over many decades in some cases to come to what you actually think.
But I'm curious about your point of view on this as a non-enrolled voter. I'm the same. I'm enrolled as a blank. I'm not in a political party. That in the city of Albany, I had a wonderful colleague, Joanne Krupe, was the editor of our opinion pages and shared the managing editor's role with me for a few years. And Joanne was enrolled in a party because she said as a resident of the city, she wanted to have a voice. And Albany is a Democratic city. She said, I don't have a voice if I'm not in the party.
Right, because you have to register in a primary in New York. We should make that clear to our listeners.
Right.
You have to be registered in a party, unlike Massachusetts, for example.
Very good point.
It kills me. I never miss a vote. Library board, whatever, I'm always there, and I've got to sit this one out, even though I've paid very close attention, and I know the candidates, and I know what I think about their relative strengths.
And that's the other thing we lost, the credibility of the newspaper or journalism to make these kinds of analyses, to do these editorial endorsements, because we are paying attention to the situation and probably know better than most as to what the issues are and who may be the best choice.
Credit where credit's due. Your former paper, the Times Union, weighed in on the New York City race and said, we know Andrew Cuomo better than anyone, and he probably shouldn't be back in office.
Yeah. Interesting. That coming from an editorial board that always endorsed him when he ran for governor, notwithstanding attacking him once he got into the job. It is interesting. And I'm sure a lot of downstate people, those who might have noticed, would say, what's this upstate paper doing? Anyway, these topics we will have a lot more to talk about after the election. And that's the end of our commentary beforehand, right?
Hey, write to us. We never get any letters.
Media at WAMC.
We do, too.
We do.
We just read one.
How about that? David Gustina there, Ian Pickus, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us and hope you'll come back again next week for the Media Project.
To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's uncle.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and WAMC news director Ian Pickus. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.